Facebook Live.
Love Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Just because we're snowed in doesn't mean that I'm stop me from doing what I need to do. We're going to have a phenomenal show today, and we're going to talk about things that we have to learn about the world and how we learn to deal with the other people. So wouldn't it be nice to end the suffering, confusion, and temptation and sin in a world where we hear so much hate, violence, and destruction on the news, and we see in the streets the words which within the pages of this book will help you plan your life, as well as God's reason for granting you the most powerful element of his creation, the power of choice. That's something that I think that everybody needs to learn, and they need to understand the consequences of your bad decision or choices. So I am excited, and we have Pastor Michael Jones, and the title of the book is To Be a Seventh-day Adventist Christian, and I learned a lot from reading this book. It taught me a lot. So good morning from cold Westchester up here to sunny Florida, right?
That's right, Fenn. A pleasant good morning to you. How are you today?
I'm just cold. Freezing and cold, but okay. What can I say? But as I read this book and I took notes and underlined, I realized that a lot of young people can learn a lot from reading this book. And a lot of adults can learn some serious lessons. So what was the inspiration behind writing this book?
Well, you know, Fran, for the longest time, I've been really troubled by, you know, the fact that something that is of God has been so discussed, so agreed with, so disagreed with, to the point where it's creating so much controversy. And I wanted to get to truth for myself instead of accepting what we call generation hand-me-downs. And that's what started it all. The teachings were good from my parents and from grandparents, were wonderful, but I had always been a child with a curious mind. And when I started listening to the debates and different things like that, I said, well, it's time for me to discover for myself. So I went on a quest and started searching for that.
I could understand that. You know, it's very hard sometimes when people do things that are not right and mean to you. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to have to deal with them. So for those of the people that are listening, and I have it on my Facebook wall, I don't do a chat room because I find that people in chat rooms are not always they don't always write the right thing. So I don't want to deal with that. So I've put down that if anybody has a question, they can put it on my Facebook wall and I'll answer it. So define for our listeners, and there's a lot of people that listen, I can tell you that, what is the definition of a Seventh-day Adventist Christian so they understand the meaning behind the title?
Okay. An Adventist Christian is one who believes that the seventh day of the week is the holy Sabbath day, as according to the Ten Commandments God initially laid down. And they've held fast to that despite the differences in opinions that have evolved over the years. Adventist Christians believe in a second coming. They believe in, you know, everything that is written in the Bible without debate, without differences, without dissension. And over the years, some have been ridiculed for it, been set aside, been called cultish because of what has been written many, many years ago and what they still believe in today. So they believe that the Sabbath day, the seventh day, is the official worship day that God has designated for all humankind.
Yeah, I do. Now, do you consider it Saturday or Sunday? Because different people consider different days.
Right. Well, I think when folk look at the calendars that we observe now, according to the Bible, Sunday really is the first day of the week. And then on through, we find that the seventh day ends on Saturday, and hence the Sabbath day that the Bible talks about.
Well, that we celebrate on Saturday. So when I was growing up, we didn't do anything except, you know, go to synagogue or do whatever on Saturday. And, you know, no writing, no reading. You could read, but no, you know, going to the movie or anything, it had to be Saturday. So what is the significance of the Sabbath, and why is it important to keep God's laws? Because that's, you know, something that I definitely agree with.
Okay, great. The significance is, it has a few, actually. The first one is that it is a memorial of the creation. When you look through the Bible in the book of Genesis, it talks about the exact day-to-day layout of how the world was created. And then the very last verse that winds up creation is that God created the Sabbath day. In fact, in Exodus 20, which has all the commandments, it's the only one, the seventh day Sabbath, that says remember. It is the only one with the word remember in front of it, because, of course, God in his wisdom knew that man would tend to forget, whether unintentionally or intentionally, just violate that day. So he said, remember the Sabbath day. So it's a remembrance of, you know, creation. The second thing is in Isaiah, and I should have these references for you, Fred, but they're in one of my books, is that it's a foreshadowing of the holy or the official worship day in heaven for those who believe in the heaven. It tells you that from one new moon to another and from one Sabbath to another, he says that all flesh will come to worship before me. So that's what's going to happen there. Other references in New Testament talks about the fact that, you know, Jesus was out in the fields working with the poor during the week, but on the seventh day, on the Sabbath day, you could find him in the synagogues, you know, preaching the word of God. And so the disciples as well. So not only did Jesus keep the seventh day Sabbath, but also the disciples that were with him, you know, as well. He also talks about the fact that if you were to put away your things and call the Sabbath a delight, then God will open up the windows of heaven and bless you until there's no more room to receive it. So it's a day that is wrapped with blessings directed from God. And it's so hard for, I think, people to understand that. Sorry, because it is on a spiritual level. It's just nothing they can see in front of their eyes that's tangible to them. And that part takes us into a whole nother realm, because we have to just trust God, believe in what he says, do the things he wants out of obedience to be able to benefit from things yet unseen.
No, I agree with you. What did you learn about keeping the Sabbath? That was very interesting, by the way, when I read how you had a job, you got a promotion, and then you had to be available 24/7. And my husband just retired from the job like that. So how do you handle it? And what made you decide that, no, this is not going to happen and this is not wrong? It's taking away from the Sabbath. It's taking away from what I believe in. What made you decide that 24/7 was not the right thing?
Well, you know, I mentioned before, Fran, intentional disobedience. I had observed the Sabbath forever. And then taking this job, I knew of the requirements. Even before I accepted, even before I signed the paper, I knew I should have consulted with God first, because maybe he has something better in mind for me. And I know in my heart that he would have been pleased had I stood up as a witness to my employers then and say, listen, you know, I will work 6 days of the week. The commandment said that. But on this day is God's holy day. I can't accept the job. I wouldn't decline it, but I would give them an opportunity to do a workaround and say, okay, great, listen, if you're that committed to your day of worship, you know, we admire your commitment, and we might have had, you know, been able to make some kind of provisions for you to work that day. But I never trusted God enough. I wanted to step out and make my own decisions. And it was the worst feeling in my life, Fran. I felt so guilty over it, but I knew I was wrong, and I didn't know how to approach it. So when I started getting phone calls in church, oh my God, that really helped to push me further into guilt mode. And I had to be running out of the temple to go and handle, you know, calls at work.
Yeah.
And to me, it was just, it was utter chaos in my life. And I had to do something, you know, about that. So how I dealt with that was I found myself going back to God and really, you know, confessing to him of how distraught I had become, how unhappy I was, because I had made a decision without him, without his approval. And now it was plaguing me to death, and that I needed him to provide a solution, because I could not, you know, I couldn't carry on in the manner that I was. So it led me to prayer and fasting a lot more often than I normally would have. And that's how I was, you know, how I had to deal with it. It was through him.
No, I agree with you. Sometimes I stand in the middle of something that's happening that I'm not happy with, and I'll look up and I'll just say, you know, to talk to God and say, you know, how do I deal with this? Am I going to be okay?
Mm-hmm.
Am I going to be able to push through? And somehow you just know, and you hope that he's here. Mm-hmm. Hope he listens.
Yeah.
I've been through some horrific times this year. So I have the book in front of me. I have all of your books in front of me. There are I keep them. You know, a lot of times after I read a book, I just give it away, but not these. Not these, because when I get lose faith in myself or something bothers me, I just pick up a chapter and read it, and I say, okay, this is going to be fine. I'm going to be okay.
Oh, God. Thank you so much.
Yeah, this, let me tell you, this girl learned a lot. There are 6 proven success methods to obtaining bonus blessings. The 7th day includes, it says, follow God's work schedule, invest spiritual treasures. You see, I got these memorized, people. Better opportunities.
Wow.
Take a firm but elegant stance against working on the 7th day. Develop action steps and allow transformation to take place. How did you decide on those particular 6?
You know, after much prayer, after much, you know, consulting with God, these were the takeaways for me. These were the lessons that I've learned that he wanted to teach me, and you know, that's what came, that's the learning that came out of that. So in the beginning, I should have taken a firm but elegant step, and you have to your speech has to be seasoned with salt, as the word says, because not everyone knows what you know, and not everyone understands what you understand. So the point is to create better value for what you have to talk about. There's no point in being upset, because you're the one that created the mess. So that's something I should have done, because once I said before, God might have had a different plan for me, or I didn't give him the opportunity to open another door. And so when we do that, we tend not to block our own blessings. You know, we tend to, most people tend to take burdens upon themselves, and they want to solve problems on their own, and not remembering that God sees everything. He knows that moment would have arrived in your life before it even got there. So why not talk to him about it? And for me, that was a really, really big lesson. Violating it actually led to intentional disobedience, because I knew about it. And so God was allowing some things to take place in my life that really made me uncomfortable. It made me happy. I was rejoicing my own success, because I was being promoted now to, you know, the managerial level. And I was excited about the pay raise. I was excited about the title and the respect that came with it. But at the same time, it was like I was slapping God in the face, because I went on my own feelings, my own accord, without saying, you know, what do you think about this? Is this right? Should I do this? You know, do you have something else in mind? Because so for me, that was the biggest step, the biggest takeaway was for me to learn that I cannot trust my own wisdom when I am connected to God. He gives me everything that I need, and I should always be dependent on Him, especially for wisdom. So out of all the things I've written, you know, regarding the seventh-day Sabbath and its observance, and it all comes out of how strong the relationship with God and how much do I trust Him with everything in my life. You know, friend, the Word tells us that He even knows the amount of hairs on your head. And sometimes we forget that He cares even about the little things. And we go ahead and step in front of Him and run into a whole lot of trouble. So that's what happened to me there. And by not standing up for what I believed in, you know, I knew I felt guilty. And that's where everything else, you know, kind of took place surrounding that.
You know, it's funny because I get criticized for doing exactly that, because if I believe in something, I'm going to stand up for myself. I wasn't always like that. But I realized that if you don't express yourself or ask the right questions, then you're just going to fall by the wayside. So the next part of the book that really taught me a lot, okay, the habit of praying without ceasing is important. This one is really very important. The habit of loving without condition. But the one that got me the most, and this is the hardest one, the habit of forgiving others. When people do things to you that are not right, how do you forgive someone when that creates a situation in your life that's definitely never going to change? And the other one, for every teenager out there and adult, this is something that I learned from my mother, the habit of profanity-free speech. There's no reason why you have to use bad language to express yourself. You know, trust me, I'm a believer in that. The habit of avoiding evil they need to learn, and the habit of being humble in character, and the habit of fasting with prayer. But the one, how do you deal with, seriously, with forgiving someone that has caused a change in your life, not for the better, and you're not sure whether they meant to do it or not, and how do you forgive someone like that?
That's a great question, because it's one of the hardest elements of life to deal with. And how I dealt with that, how I had to deal with that, was I can't take credit for myself, not even for a solution to conflict or even potential conflict. The Bible tells us that we should do all things to the glory of God, and that includes seeking Him for direction when it comes to conflict. And He's made some provisions for that, and He's given us some specific directions for that. Ephesians 4:26 tells us that as humans, it's okay to be upset, is that we can be upset, but we have a limit on that anger, which He said that you have to resolve this by the setting of the sun. So we can talk to a tree, we can do whatever, rant and rave, but at the setting of the sun, and this is not just on the Sabbath day, mind you, friend, this is every day of, is that we have to make peace with whoever it is that we've had that conflict with. It is vital, not because it pleases us, but because it pleases God. You know, and that's where we have to keep the focus. It is off man and on God. So even if we went to someone who's done us wrong, or who we feel that we've been wronged by, as a maturing Christian, or as a maturing one who's maturing in our relationship with God, we have to engage that first set of steps to bring peace. Not because, hello, are you there, friend?
Yep, I'm here.
Hello? Yeah,
I'm here.
Not because, and it's okay if we should want approval from God, but whether it pleases the accuser or not, we should still engage, whether they accept it or not, because it pleases God. And that's the central point of forgiveness. The next thing is that it releases us from that heightened sense of conflict. When you know that you've been wronged or someone, you've wronged someone, it tends to stay on your mind. It stays in your heart. And it's hard to connect with God through His Spirit, because we're now focused on a human element that has our minds all wrapped up and not able to function. You know, a study was done by a Cleveland Clinic here in Florida, one of the finer hospitals there is. They said that the human brain is capable of generating between 60 and 80,000 thoughts per day. And when we become engaged in conflict with another, it tends to consume most of our thinking and prevents us from focusing on God. So that's one thing that's very dangerous for us. The next thing is that we're instructed that when you are in conflict with another, your worship is not acceptable to God. And this is where it got really serious for me, because now you're in church, you're in your temple, trying to give honor and glory to God, trying to connect with Him on a spiritual level, taking yourself out of the world and going to a spiritual level. And next thing you know, you're unable to do that. So it is so important to God. He said, listen, if this is the case with you, leave your offering at the altar and get out of the building. I don't want you in here. Get out and go and make peace before returning to the temple. So when I think about wasting time on my knees, when I think about traveling to the temple or to church, and yet I have a dagger in my heart for someone, I know that my worship, God doesn't even want to hear that. So the only thing that's important at that time is my offering. He said, set it down and go to make peace. However you do that, it's so important. I won't listen to you until that part of your worship is done. You can't come to me with a clean spirit. You cannot come to me totally mine and give me honest and sincere worship. So, you know, when these when I read and really understood the severity of what, you know, the Bible was talking about, I said, oh my gosh, you know, the human element kicked in now, because I'm saying, well, what if I'm upset with Fran and she doesn't accept my apology? You know, she spits on the ground in front of me and said, Mike, look, I don't want to talk to you today. You know, we become more concerned about someone's reaction as opposed to God's provision and His blessings. And that's where He wants us to take ourselves out of the human element, do what He wants to do regardless of the results from another, and then deal with Him on a spiritual level. And it was just, that revelation was so amazing, because it took a lot of burdens, you know, off my heart. You know, sometimes, Fran, we hurt someone unintentionally that we care and that we love about, and we're so afraid of rejection that, you know, we'll tend to procrastinate and not settle our grievances by the sunset that God wants. And hence, we end up going past that time frame and start to sin, because now unresolved differences can convert itself into anger. And you're thinking about, okay, you know, well, I'm just going to run over her toes in the parking lot. He said, thou shalt not kill, right? And next thing you know, it goes into a whole nother, you know, sphere of unforgiveness and sinning. And we might not even wake up the following day. And so we die without, you know, making restitution. So when I learned those lessons, I said, oh my God, you know, I wonder how many people are living with all this stress, all this baggage of non-forgiveness. And that's one of the things, one of the habits that successful people who are connected to God must work diligently on to please God, not ourselves, but to please God in order to gain favor in His sight.
I agree with you because I try to, I lost my cousin a year ago on December 27th.
Mm-hmm.
And we had just reconnected because she was, you know, doing things, whatever. And we never spoke to each other. And I didn't know
wow.
she was very sick. So we stayed connected for a very long time. The
mm-hmm.
sad part is that she told me, she made me promise that I would never tell her sister that she was sick. And I said, don't you want to speak to her before you die? Don't you want to, you know, God doesn't want you to be angry anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't ask what caused the rift. I have an idea. They never spoke at all.
Wow.
And when
wow.
she died, sad, it's when she died, her son was given the choice of whether he told her sister or not. And I think he did, but I don't know what kind of an impact it made on her. But I know I had to keep my promise to her, and it bothered me. So last week, on the 27th of December, I posted something on Facebook to Sherry with her picture to letting her sister know that this is what happened, and if you want to say something to the family or join in, you know, feel free to
mm-hmm.
express your thoughts. You know, we forgive you for whatever happened. It's horrible. It's a hard feeling, and I'm doing
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm working on it with myself. So chapter 3 is really good because I read this a couple of times. Everyone in the world has debts. It's just me.
Yes.
After paying all that money for my mom's home care, but you know what? I kept her home and I kept her safe with help with people. So the fact that I went into financial debt was to pay for her home care until I got full services. That was worth it. And now I'm paying it
wow.
off. But it was, yeah, I wouldn't put her in a facility ever. So there are 8 spiritual principles. Which ones do you think are the most important, besides the fact that anyone that accumulates debts, if you can pay them right away, I agree with you, get rid
mm-hmm.
of them. Which one would you
mm-hmm.
say are the one, and debts can hinder you because you worry about it every single month. How am I going to pay this? What am I going to do? What advice would you give to someone rather than put themselves in a hole like that?
Well, of the 8, the first one that I really want to talk about is
okay.
that we need to dismiss the idea that we own the money or the
mm-hmm.
property that we have acquired. God, when He created the garden, He put man in charge to be a good steward. But somehow through sin and through the years, we've developed this whole idea that we're owners of things. And in the long term, it makes life difficult for us because we go out of our way many times to control or to develop this ownership mentality, and hence we put ourselves in debt to try and capture this whole concept. So I think the very first thing we have to do is say, no matter how much we have in the bank, it all belongs to God, and that we are merely stewards of what He gives us to control. And I think that takes a lot of pressure mm-hmm. off of our lives. You know, we worry about not having enough all the time, even
mm-hmm.
if we do and even if we're not. So in a more humbling position, you know, we find that we'll set aside the egos and live on the inside of what God gives us. You know, I talk about redefining current lifestyles. Number 3 is that
mm-hmm.
many people tend to live a lot higher than they ought to. They want to impress the Joneses. They
mm-hmm.
they want to drive the best car in the neighborhood. They want to live in a brownstone. And all these things add to number 1. You are not the owner of this stuff. You are going to go to sleep one day, and someone else is going to be inside of your property. Someone else is going to take your possessions. So we're just here for a flicker in time. And once we understand that, then everything else becomes you know, falls into perspective. It is difficult to co-sign for somebody else, especially on large items. That's reason number five. It is, I have owed debt where out of good conscience, I wanted to help someone and co-sign for them. There is big danger in that, because if the person couldn't afford to get what they felt they wanted, there's a problem right there. You know, you're actually co-signing, which means that you're marrying yourself to that person's debt. Should they lose a job, lose their life, lose all the sustaining factors that once were able to help them to afford it, now you've assumed the debt. Now your credit gets impacted. Your finances get impacted, all because of one word, help, or two words, help me. You have to evaluate that as a relationship that's just like a marriage. And if you know, you ask the same questions the bank does, and if the person is not able to answer that, then you're setting yourself up for disaster. I know it sounds rough, really horrible, friend, kind of abrasive, but that's one thing I advise people not to do if it's something they can absolutely control, or they're aware of the dangers of, you know, co-signing for another, is to stay away from that. I, too, am a caretaker for, you know, my dad. And I put him on a budget.
You know? I agree with you.
I mean, after a while, his wants become his needs, and I said, "No, Dad. You know, we have to separate those two things, and we have to redefine your current lifestyle. You're not making as much as you used to make. You have to make some adjustments that are more healthy, that are more conscious." You know, for you. So in so doing, it's allowed me not to have him accumulate so much debt. I give you a perfect example. You know, back in the day, during his time, maybe cable was the only option for him to watch television. Now here you sit with $100 bill per month, knowing that if you don't pay that on your limited income, you're going to be without TV. And at a certain point in time, that's extremely important to the seniors. So, you know, looking for options, you find that there are different ways to get access to channels. You know, you have YouTube, you have so many different, you know, Fire Stick, you have so many different options now that don't cost you much. So you can either reduce a bill or eliminate a bill. And that's the thinking that comes into play. So even caring for parents, even thinking about your loved ones, we have to be stewards. The whole rule of stewardship has to come into place, whether we've been placed in position to manage theirs or how we issue ours to others. God loves that. And when he sees that, friend, he'll say, oh, okay, you know, my son Michael or my daughter friend is managing the stuff that I give them to manage, so I'm going to trust them with more. And that's what he does. So because it all comes from God, regardless of the circumstances, when we trust him and he sees that we are taking care, that we're conscious of that level of trust, he actually supplies more. This is when you see stage four cancer. You see all the difficult elements in life through prayer starts to disappear, because you're saying, you know, God, I'm at a point in my faith where, you know, we're running out of finances. Some very difficult circumstances are taking place in my life, and I can't stretch that far. I need you to either eliminate or bridge this gap for me. And, you know, the amazing thing is many times he does. And it's all because we are so conscious about what he can do in our lives based on where we are in our relationship with him. It's just that
well,
we take on too much sometimes. Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
So those are.
Those are important. And let me tell you something. Every time I forget, I try to teach one of my cousins that impulse buying is dangerous. And that buying something just because someone else has it is wrong, and it puts you in debt. Mm. And then what I find happening to this person is they wind up bringing everything back. I said, and after a while,
gosh.
you keep bringing stuff back to a store, they're going to tell you not to come anymore. Because after a while, they go, she's back again. But before I forget, Tuesday, a very unusual book called Down to No Good, 11 o'clock is my show with Dennis Wilson. Mm-hmm. On the 10th, a very interesting show with John Vanderslice, The Last Words of Oscar Wilde. And his life was interesting, and the book was really good. On the 16th, the book is Countdown. Hello. Uh-oh, Michael's phone died. He has to call back in. I'm going to tell him to call back in. He got disconnected. While I'm doing that, I'm going to talk you more. Countdown by Carrie Baldwin. Also on the 23rd, Child of Creation. On the 26th, we've got 29th, we've got 26th, we've got Rick Acker, and on the 26th, we have Michael Coyle. So I'm waiting for the author to call back in. I don't know what happened. Just now we got disconnected, so I'm going to tell him call back in. And let me see if I can get him back on the phone because something happened and it went out. I don't know why. That's so weird. Let's see if I can call him at this particular point. Oh, here he is.
Got dropped there.
I have no idea what happened just now.
That is so crazy. Must be all the snow you're having up there.
I don't know. Okay, we're fine now. Okay, let me ask the next question. Hopefully we won't get disconnected. I don't know. That's Blog Talk. Okay.
Oh, sorry.
The next question is, after talking about forgiveness and everything, why do people think that sometimes bad things happen to good people? How do you deal with that and not say, well, God made bad things happen to me? Why do bad things happen to good people?
It happens because God allows it. You know, Fran, one of the most interesting stories for me in the Bible was the one of Job, who this man, he was enjoying all the wealth of the land. He had a beautiful family. He was perfect in every way. He obeyed God's commandments. He had a very, very strong prayer life, and he did everything that pleased God. But Satan grew not just weary, but he grew very jealous of the relationship that Job had developed with his maker. And so he challenged God that if he were to, you know, disrupt his life, if he were to, you know, take normal things and turn them into horrible things in Job's life, Job would curse God to his face. And so God allowed some extremely horrible things to be done to Job because he wanted to show Satan the strength of their relationships. And as you probably know, you know, Satan destroyed everything that this man had. He caused boils to appear all over his body. He killed all his cattle. And, you know, Job was extremely prosperous. He was an amazing, amazing steward. So God gave him a lot. And all his kids died. And he still held fast to his relationship with God. He would never once utter a curse word. In fact, his wife had gotten to the point where Job was so miserable. She told him to just curse God and die, you know, just get out of your misery. because it is so much. I can't bear to see you like this. He told her, he said, you know, don't talk like a foolish woman, because God gives us everything and he is everything to me. And so I look at that story, the positioning of that story is that when we are right with God, he expects our commitment to him to be so strong that not even death could keep us apart if, you know, we believe in the thereafter one day. Is that we just go to sleep until he comes back and be assured of our place in heaven. But coming back to the story is that we don't have to necessarily do anything bad to go through tests. Sometimes God might be saying, look at my daughter Fran. You know, she is pleasing to me. She does everything that pleases me, and she will not turn against me, Satan. So either go your way or test her. He told he told the devil one thing. He said, look, he said, you can test, run any kind of tests you like on Job, but don't kill him. So Satan deployed everything he had. Even he needs permission because he has a limit as to how far he can go with us. And that is just, to me, an amazing thing. So God allows certain things because he wants to show off, he wants to show us off to the devil that he has no control over our lives. On the opposite side of that, though, people always want to test God's authority. They want to test his sovereignty. And so they step out in bold disobedience to him to show how brass they are and how much power and how much control they have and how much wealth they have amassed. Until one day he allows stage 4 cancer to step in. He allows, you know, deaths in families. He allows some things to remind people that he is still in charge and that no matter how high we think we are, we're still under the feet of God. So as painful as it sounds and as loving as he is, it's hard to believe that, you know, I talk to a lot of homeless people, and some of them blame God for their circumstances. One lady told me, she said, look, I want God to come down here right now and tell me why my life is so difficult. And I realized that some people really don't understand God's positioning, you know, in the supernatural. They because they don't know God, they know of him. They expect that they can have this jack-in-the-box experience with him where they're having a bad day and they call on God and automatically everything's supposed to be well. And when he doesn't respond in the time frame that we want, we go to find relief someplace else. And that's a very disturbing thing. It's just like Job. He could have easily done some weird things, but it would have ruptured that relationship with God. People here, they find drugs, they find alcohol. They try to find all these temporary solutions that just don't work. And when nothing's working for them, they get truly, truly disrespectful to their maker. Like this lady, she wants him to show up and make her life right. Well, you know, you have other people who believe in witchcraft. Other people who've completely substituted God's sovereignty position in the world and out of it for, you know, necromancy, somebody who's a sorceress or a sorcerer, providing a counterfeit of who God is. And those people have no connection to God because they've made a choice to do without him. Today, Fran, I'm sure you've heard all the news where people are kicking God out of schools. They're kicking him out of the workplace. And they wonder why he allows things to happen to them that they consider bad. Well, you don't want him around. So now you're at the peril. You're at the control of Satan, who enjoys making your life hell. And you go, well, where is God when you need him? Well, you threw him out of your life. You threw him out of your home. You threw him out of your kid's school, out of your, even some of the churches.
Exactly.
And now they're wondering where he is. He's never left you. The word of God tells us that his very spirit is inside you. But the thing is that you can't have a connect. You can't connect with him because part of his provisions for your life is missing. And this is where, you know, there's this major disbelief that God exists. When you say, Satan is my God, like so many people are doing, you're going to have some problems. You're going to have some disturbance in your days that sometimes make you not want to be alive. And God allows these. The only thing is, it looks horrible to us, friend, because we don't have the capability to evaluate on a perfect level. We're not perfect. Only God knows the long and short of our lifespans and the stories that take place. So we can't see things the way he does. We see people on the surface, but we don't know what their connection with him is. So when they're doing something that is not on the inside of his will, because they don't talk to him, they don't know what he wants for their lives, and he allows some things to happen, then we end up blaming God. So, you know, I've found the words he uses, don't judge one another, leave the judgment to me. I think that is not only appropriate, it's also one that puts us in our place. That all God wants us to do is love one another. And that is the hardest thing to do because we are more comfortable judging one another. So I think if we were to ask for his guidance in changing that mindset where we look at people as a divine creation as opposed to one that is full of evil and terrible to us, you know, he says that on our best day, our own self-righteousness is like filthy rags to him. But we've elevated ourselves. Man has elevated himself to the level where he feels that he is capable of casting judgment upon another. We're just a lump of clay. We're nothing. You know, one statement in one of the books of Psalms, it really captured my attention, and it sounds really brutal, but that's the sum of it all. It says, it says, if we were to lay the carcass of a man next to that of a dog, after a while, you won't know the difference. It will all just blow away in the wind. And that's what we are. We're just a clump of clay. And after a while, we've been reduced to nothing. So, you know, we have to make our time count here and live inside the will of God, because he is coming back and he wants us to understand that he is only coming back for the people who are willing to live by the guidelines he's placed here through his Ten Commandments. And through the two new commandments he's created in the new commandments, he's created two new commandments. He said, without loving your neighbor as yourself and without loving the Lord your God with all your heart, he is telling you that unless you're capable and willing to engage yourself in these levels of love with the people and him, he said it's impossible to keep the first 10 that he wrote in stone with his own fingers. So we have a big part to play in our own salvation, and that's where the power of choice comes in. And so, you know, he has to allow some things to happen because, friend, we are out of control. I mean, you know, nuclear weapons, and people think they have the right to destroy lives, and, you know, God has to allow some things to happen to kind of get our attentions off ourselves and our own power and our own desires. Because could you imagine people who think that way? And this is no judgment call. It's just an observation. Mm-hmm. Could you imagine with people wanting to destroy the world, God allowing them into heaven, can you understand what heaven would be like if man is allowed to rain the destruction upon others and upon the planet that he created for us to prosper now, if he were to allow them to go there? So yeah, what we see as bad, God sees as amazing, and he knows what he's doing. So, you know, we have to just trust him. It's okay, and release that from ourselves so that we can live in harmony and our minds can become more in alignment with true power, with true provisions, with all the amazing things that he has planned for us.
I have a couple more questions, but you know, it's funny because I grew up in the South Bronx. And I grew I didn't get this right for nothing, people. Yep, I did. But the one thing that I loved about living in the Bronx at times was that there were so many different kinds of people there. And it never bothered me. And I just walked down the street and said good morning to everybody. Didn't matter who it was.
Wow.
Up here, it's different. I'll say good morning to people, and they'll just look at you like, are you serious? And I sort of force them to say good morning, because that's the way you start your day. You're just walking in the street, and people walk by, and they go, good morning, it's nice to see you, or how are you, have a nice day. And I think people lost that. They lost that. My husband had to go to Social Security, and this girl was standing there. She looked so sad. I said, are you okay? She said, yeah. I said, oh, that's a really pretty scarf. Well, she perked up. And
you don't
know that sometimes something that you say, this older woman walked in and she said, I went on the wrong floor. I said, well, now you're in the right floor. Come with me. I'll show you where to go. I mean, you don't know. Sometimes you say the nicest things to someone, and it bothers me when people are so negative. So after reading your book, after reading all of Michael's books, every one of them, and I'm waiting for the next one, what are the most important things that you hope that readers will take away? Now, I'm saying that this book is good for group discussions, teaching young adults how to behave properly and respect God's will and work. How can parents, teachers, guidance counselors, even in secular schools, not religious schools, use what you wrote to teach children to be more respectful and not use bad language? I mean, I know I hear teenagers, not so much around here, on the street using bad language, or you hear, you know, a relative using bad language, and I go, excuse me, not in my face, nuh-uh.
Mm-hmm.
What would you hope people learn from reading this? Because I really feel that there's a better way to say things other than using profanity. I've always been taught that. My mother, never in a million years would she allow something like that. How do you teach kids to understand that the way you present yourself is the way people are going to look at you? And what would you like people to learn from after reading your book?
Great question. Thank you so much for that. Well, it's so amazing when you talk about your observations of how changed cultures are becoming. They're actually shifting wholesome living to recreate, you know, just what takes place in a particular part of geography to the point where it is atrocious. I mean, even educated folks who you expect so much from in terms of their language, it is absolutely shocking. All I say to people is, listen, if you believe there's a heaven, start practicing the speech that you know and feel in your heart that'll be there. The first thing, you know, kids need to understand is what the Bible says, even about long life. I'm going to talk about this in two parts, and I'll be very brief. Is one, that it's not going to the gym and drinking all the powerful milkshakes that you hear about that prolongs life. It says, honor your mother and your father so that your days will be longer. See, since God controls the hands of time, if you want to live longer than you are right now based on your own wisdom, then you need to honor your parents. That's the first thing. So, you know, when you don't throw them to the side because they're aging, they might forget where they put, you know, their keys and stuff like that. that's a lesson for us. And God wants us to learn to draw from these things when it comes to patience with others. You don't curse at your parents because they were created in the similitude of God. So when we use foul language to berate someone's character, to curse them, or to bring attention to yourself, you're actually cursing God's handmaid. So you're disrespecting God himself, and you're placing curses upon your own head. And to me, those simple explicatives that might sound so good to the ear of your peers are actually corrosives that melt the very heart of God. And kids understand when you talk to them and build value, but I find a lot of the parents now, especially next gen parents, are using the same language that they're supposed to teach their kids not to use. So the kids are hearing it in school, they're hearing it at home, they're hearing it in the shopping malls. I see parents that drop their kids off at the shopping mall and say, oh, I'll be back here by, 6 o'clock. They don't know what's happening during that space of time, who their friends are, what kind of language they're listening to when they're playing their music. So, my advice to parents is that you need to take a very stronger role in becoming friends with your kids, in listening to what they listen to, because the devil comes to us through music. Pay attention to who their friends are. Don't allow them to just sleep over at just anybody's house. You have to know those parents. You have to know how they're raising their kids. And if it's not in concordance, if it's not in alignment with good and wholesome upbringing, no, son, you cannot sleep at Johnny's house. No, daughter, you definitely can't do this. And here's why. Explain it to them. Show them biblical principles as to why Christ never spoke that way, and you shouldn't either. I mean, it's so funny, friend, and I have to admit this. A very long time ago, I used to enjoy a bottle of Corona. I was in Australia one time, and I had this nice, cold, tall bottle. And as I lifted it to my head, image of Christ standing there, and I said, the ordinary question you'd ask a friend is, can I buy you a drink? And he was just looking at me. And, I put that bottle down and I've never returned to it. So I think it's important that we have the image of Christ. When we go on vacation, we plan in our minds and we make those wishes or dreams for some a reality by planning and thinking about it and salivating about that cruise until we fulfill those expectations. But we never do that with heaven because it's not visual to us. But I think because we have that mind that's capable of so many thoughts, if we were to wrap it around a perfect place where there's no more tears, no more sorrows, then we can also think about the language. The Bible said is to season your language with salt. In other words, hear yourself when you talk. Think about what you talk. Mm-hmm. The dictionary is there. The encyclopedia is there. Wikipedia is there. Enough words that you can choose and select the ones that are more conducive to great relationships and making us not only compliant with that of heaven, but accustomed to what are going to talk when we get there. It's in pure perfection. I don't even know what that's like. But if we practice now, we'll have better relationships. We will have better opportunities, and things like that. So that would be my advice, is for the parents to get to be friends with the kids, not to become like them, but to set the examples that should be set from the onset. And I think we'll see better homes, better communities, and better churches.
I agree with you. So before we end, because we went over the time, but that's okay, because I do that all the time.
I'm so sorry.
That's okay. Where can everyone learn more about all of your books and your homeless, helping the homeless in your parish?
They can go to my website at begintoserve.org. We serve in 7 countries. and it's just an amazing, amazing experience. Yes, we just finished building, we're building water wells in Africa and India to feed people. We teamed up with Home Depot and we provide them with seeds. And so those seeds spin a crop every 90 days and people are now able to eat healthy and drink fine water coming from the center of the earth. They no longer fear droughts and things like that that often come by and dehydrate and kill people. But my books are all available right now on Amazon. I have The Everlasting Benefits of Obedience by me, Michael A. Jones. We have Revive the Champion in Me that was written through my experience with people on the streets, the poor, the homeless. And, you know, ironically, I drew courage from them. In fact, I slept down there on the streets to really understand street living and what is it that impacts people's lives. So that book was designed specifically to, you know, help people with who are going through depression in their lives, you know, stuck on alcohol, broken relationships, and all those things, to empower them to get back on the top side of society living. You know, then we have To Be a Seventh-day Adventist Christian. It talks about something very stern in there. It talks about stinginess of Christians, of people who believe in a generous God, but yet we're so stingy towards each other. And there's no blessing involved in that. That makes for a very interesting discussion. And people are finding great value there. So my next upcoming book is going to be Connected But Not Converted. And Fran, you hit on it. You know, we talk about being connected to Christ, but we're not talking like him. Many people who are still in churches or synagogues are still using tremendous profanity. Christ don't talk that way. Our character, play up our very character towards our neighbors, towards senior citizens, towards those who are helpless in society, is not one that's indicative of a follower of God. And so this book is present day. It brings forward the many issues that prevent the success on a spiritual level that takes place in people's lives. And I think the timing is perfect. I think that, you know, it's important to highlight these issues, although they may be so harsh for some. But we need to hear the truth. And that's what Connected But Not Converted, you know, is going to do. I mean, Fran, you know, I overheard a conversation with two people who, they were going to a strip club. And it turned into this present-day joke for them, was that they're going to this strip club to do whatever they do there, and then in the following morning, they're getting ready to go to church. Connected but not converted. So
I don't know.
There's so, so many other examples, and it just, to me, came to mind that we really, these are things that we really need to talk about, so the book should be an interesting read. And they're all available on Amazon. This one will be as well. And, you know, hopefully people will find enough value in them as their life progresses towards what many call a better place, hopefully in God.
Well, I'm going to post, I reposted the review of your book this morning, and I'm going to go on Amazon in about a minute, and I'm going to post the links to all of your books on my Facebook wall, so that everybody gets them and read them. And I hope I get the next one, too. We'll definitely do another interview when you get the next one. Because all of your books are on my shelf, and now I realize who is on the cover of the other book. I didn't recognize the face, but now I do. And it's beautiful. And I want to thank you so much. And I could think of several people in my own family that need to read this book, seriously. And I will stay in touch on Facebook. And Mary, if you need anything, if you want to post anything about the parish or the homeless or any of your, whatever you have, your affairs or something for the homeless, put it on my Facebook wall. Everybody reads everything I write.
Awesome.
Thank you so very much.
Awesome. I'm grateful.
The snow
I'm
is
really
coming
grateful.
down even worse now. You can't even see outside. So from
no.
horrible Westchester where there's 100 inches of snow to Florida, 50 degrees, I wouldn't even wear a jacket. Thank you so much, Michael.
Wow.
Everybody have a nice day. And
thank you,
bye.
Fran. Thank you so much. Thank you.